This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Late yesterday, after President Bush had expressed support for Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld in public, White House aides let it be known that the president was not entirely happy. In particular, he said he was said to be displeased that Secretary Rumsfeld did not let him know about the pictures of Iraqi detainees being abused by American MPs before those photos showed up in television reports. Secretary Rumsfeld canceled plans to make a speech in Philadelphia today, which triggered new questions about his future. Then White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan repeated the president's endorsement and described his displeasure as a mild rebuke of the Secretary of Defense. While some in Congress are calling for Secretary Rumsfeld to resign, he faces what could be a difficult appearance before the Senate Armed Services Committee tomorrow. In a few minutes, we'll talk with two members of that committee. Later in the program, we'll bring you up to date on the situation in the Iraqi cities of Najaf, Karbala, and Fallujah, and we'll try to figure out what's next for the Middle East after Israeli Prime Minister Sharon's own party rejected his proposed pullout plan earlier this week. But first, the political fallout from the Iraqi prisoner scandal. What issues do you think the Senate committee should focus on in tomorrow's hearings? What questions do you want to hear during that session? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now from Capitol Hill is Senator John Cornyn, Republican of Texas, a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee. Good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil. Good to be with you.
I understand you met this morning with Secretary Rumsfeld at the Pentagon. What was the subject of the discussion?
Well, this is an earlier planned meeting with four members of the Senate in anticipation of the consideration of the defense reauthorization bill. But, of course, the discussion turned rather quickly to the revelation of abuses at the Iraqi prison. Mm-hmm. It's been so much on all of our minds.
And as you know, there have been calls by some in the Senate, on the other side of the aisle, Democrats, that Secretary Rumsfeld ought to consider resigning at this point. Did that come up at all in the conversation?
Well, not in those terms directly, but I will tell you that I was much reassured that the Department of Defense and the Secretary of Defense in particular handled this matter appropriately in terms of the internal investigation and then indeed in terms of the charges that were lodged on March the 20th against six soldiers involved in this probe. It's, of course, shocking to see the pictures that we've seen, and no one is making any excuses for that. But I do understand why in the course of an investigation that in order to maintain the integrity of that investigation, and in fairness to the people accused of these crimes, that he felt it was important to keep it largely confidential.
The president was said to be upset that he was not told before the pictures were broadcast on 60 Minutes to, a week ago tomorrow, or a week ago tonight. Many in Congress were a little upset that they weren't told that this was going on.
Well, you can include me in that list. I think one of the worst things that you can do to an elected official is surprise them, because, of course, people then ask us what in the world is going on, and we didn't have the answers. But that's why I think it's so important that Secretary Rumsfeld testify in public, as I and others have called for, tomorrow at the Senate Armed Services Committee meeting here in Washington, and he will get tough questions, and I'm sure based on my meeting with him today, he will have some answers, but this is going to go on for a while until we get to the bottom of it.
Speaking of what may be tough questions, we have some callers on the line. 800-989-8255, by the way, if you'd like to join us, or you can email us, totn@npr.org. Let's begin with Kate, who's with us from St. Paul, Minnesota.
Yes, hi. I listened to the president's press secretary hearing this noon, and it looked very much as if this is going to be a kind of a cut-and-run response, saying that the guilty parties will be held accountable, but without any acknowledgement of responsibility in the Department of Defense or in CIA or ultimately the president. I'm especially worried about making sure that doesn't happen, because I think there has to have been a climate that taught those people that behavior. They didn't go over to Iraq as licentious bullies. Somebody told them that was what they were supposed to do. And I'm especially concerned that we get to the bottom of that, because I'm thinking about Jessica and Shoshana, and that they were treated well by Arab captors. But after this, it's terrifying to think of any Americans actually being captured.
Jessica Lynch and Shoshana were some of the people who were captured during the course of the war in Iraq a year ago. Senator Cornyn, are you going to ask Secretary Rumsfeld if the investigation is limited to just the soldiers who've been accused thus far? Some have been charged on court-martial charges. Some have been reprimanded. Or does it go up higher in the chain of command?
Well, I think he will be asked, and we should be told that where this story leads, and we should leave no stone unturned. But I do think it's important not to paint with too broad a brush here. From all appearances, at least here at the beginning, it appears it's a handful of misguided and actually criminal activity on behalf of a handful of soldiers. We have tens of thousands of soldiers currently fighting the war on terror who are doing a fantastic job under difficult circumstances. So I think it's important we keep this in proper context and wait until we hear what the evidence is before we brush too broadly.
Kate, thanks very much for the call.
Can I follow up?
We really need to move along to the next senator, so I wanted to ask Mr. Cornyn one more question before we move on. But thank you very much. Appreciate the phone call, Kate. Mm-hmm. And that question, Senator, is about the request for an additional $25 billion for Iraq and Afghanistan. And I guess it's two parts. Are you going to vote to approve it? And is this is the president coming up a little short on this request to avoid awkward political questions about the amount that Iraq and Afghanistan are going to cost next year?
Well, the $25 billion additional emergency funding is basically to pay for the additional troops that some have called for in Iraq. And, of course, the president said that he would respond, as had Secretary Rumsfeld, to the requests of the combatant commanders in the field. And now that they have asked and the additional troops have been granted, there has to be some way to pay for them. So I hope this will not degenerate into a partisan debate about our policies in Iraq. Indeed, it appears to me that that they are being responsive, the Secretary of Defense, the combatant commanders, to the needs on the battlefield and what we need in order to be successful. And that's something we should all support, regardless of which side of the aisle we're on.
Senator Cornyn, thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Neil.
John Cornyn, member Republican, a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, speaking with us from Capitol Hill. Of course, he represents the state of Texas. Joining us now also from the Capitol is another member of the Armed Services Committee, Senator Bill Nelson, a Democrat from Florida. And thank you for joining us on what must be a busy day up there.
Good afternoon to you.
Some of your colleagues have called for Secretary Rumsfeld to resign. Do you think that's appropriate now?
Well, let's hear what he has to say in this meeting that is anticipated tomorrow. He has just canceled the classified portion of that hearing, so it's just going to be 2 hours of public testimony. And I think it's unfortunate that they have canceled the classified portion, but let's hear what he has to say.
Well, what particular questions will be foremost in your mind?
Well, I want to know, why did he create an atmosphere, and why did he specifically say that publicly, indeed, that detainees do not have any rights under the Geneva Conventions? Why, understandably, under military law, unlawful combatants may have a minimum of rights, but usually even they, under the conventions, would be entitled to a formal hearing to determine whether they were prisoners of war or unlawful combatants. And as a result of this kind of atmosphere that was set at the top, I want to know, Mr. Secretary, why do you think that the United States, for prisoners of war, was no longer bound by the Geneva Convention? And why were your Army regulations on the interrogation of prisoners, why were they not observed? And why were detainees who were considered prisoners of war, not unlawful combatants, held incommunicado and without any independent review? That's what I want to find out.
Well, let's get another caller on the line. Brian joins us from Berkeley, California.
Yes, thank you.
Sure.
I believe that the main issue involves why the president, commander-in-chief, was not informed in the PDB or a presidential daily briefing of occurrences that may be putting our troops in harm's way when jailed combatants were mistreated. This sort of information, once gotten out, would put our troops in harm's way, and that rises to the level of a presidential briefing. Why was Rumsfeld derelict in his duty?
That is a good question. Why did it not rise to the level of a presidential briefing?
Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Brian. And if you're not satisfied with Secretary Rumsfeld's answers tomorrow, would you expect to think that might be a time to say, well, maybe it's he might want to think about stepping down?
Well, I want to hear what he has to say. I'm not going to prejudge that at this point. But, you know, the problem is in the high councils of government and also in the high councils of corporations is that the top dogs often escape the responsibility and they put it off on the lower level employees and let them become the fall guys. It looked like earlier this week that they were trying to make the fall guy the woman general in the reserves.
Brigadier General Karpinski.
And, you know, we want to know who has the responsibility. When I served in the military, I was taught that the commander assumed all responsibility for their troops. And I want to see some people stand up and start taking some responsibility. And I don't want it just put off just on the military, uniform military.
Would that be Lieutenant General Sanchez or General Abizaid, who's the central command, the general in command of the Central Command, or is it civilian military at the Pentagon, do you think?
Well, that's it. The principle that we operate is that the military answers to the civilian command. And I want to know who is going to start taking some responsibility for the fact that the Geneva Conventions were not followed. What this portends is horrific. I would not want to be a United States military person and be captured by the other side now.
Well, we've just received some news from the White House. President Bush told Jordan's King Abdullah today that he was sorry for the humiliation suffered by Iraqi prisoners. I told him, quote, I was sorry for the humiliation suffered by the Iraqi prisoners and the humiliation suffered by their family. So an apology at least coming out from the White House. Yesterday, the new commander of the prison, Abu Ghraib, apologized in Baghdad. But this an apology from the White House. And Senator Nelson, thank you for your time today. We appreciate it.
Have a good day.
You too. Senator Bill Nelson, a Democrat from Florida, he joined us from his offices up on Capitol Hill. Obviously, the Senate Armed Services Committee will be having a hearing on these issues tomorrow, and there will be extensive coverage on NPR News. When we come back from a short break, the political history of Donald Rumsfeld and later an update on the U.S. military standoff with Iraqi cleric Muqtada al-Sadr fighting today, reported from the outskirts of both Najaf and Karbala. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address, TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the political fallout from the Iraqi prisoner abuse scandal. Thus far, it seems to have settled on the man in charge at the Pentagon, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. Today, the Democratic minority leader in the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, and several U.S. senators, including Tom Harkin of Iowa and Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts, have called on Secretary Rumsfeld to resign. Donald Rumsfeld has had a long career with Republican administrations, from Nixon to Bush Sr. to his current position in the cabinet of George W. Bush. If you have questions about the longtime Washington official, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or again, you can email us, TOTN, at NPR.org. Joining us now to bring us some historical perspective on Secretary Rumsfeld's career is James Mann. He's the author of The Rise of the Vulcans, The History of Bush's War Cabinet, and a senior writer in residence at the Center for Strategic and International Studies here in Washington. He joins us from his home in Maryland. Good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Good to be with you again, Neil.
In writing your book, The History of Bush's War Cabinet, you learned about the young Donald Rumsfeld. Why was it that he decided to focus on foreign policy in the first place?
It's got to be one of the supreme ironies of history. Rumsfeld's very first venture into foreign policy. In 1971, he found himself, he was a White House aide. He'd just run the anti-poverty program, but was at the White House without any specific thing to run, and he was looking for something for to do. And he volunteered himself to the Nixon administration as someone to take charge of post-war reconstruction for the Vietnam War, post-war reconstruction in Southeast Asia. So I have no idea what will happen with Rumsfeld, whether he will resign or not. But the idea that post-war reconstruction in Iraq might be his undoing,
yes,
is full of irony.
Right now, that looks like the biggest item on a very long resume.
That's right. I mean, there's a second irony from that same period, Neil, which is that he would go into Richard Nixon for advice on what he should do for his career. What should the next step be? And Nixon used to go give lectures about what parts of the world were helpful to your career. And one of the things that Nixon told Rumsfeld one-on-one is, stay away from the Middle East. There's nothing you can do about the Middle East.
What kind of manager is Donald Rumsfeld? Is he a big picture kind of a guy or a micromanager?
He's extremely tough. He's always, both in public life and in private life, extremely tough with his subordinates, not reluctant to move people around, not reluctant to let people go, wants to be in charge of everything, may not look at the details of every operation, and that may be what's at issue here. I don't know.
Well, when we heard, and again, we're not asking for inside information about this most particular thing, but given how he has responded in the past, this report on abuses at the Iraqi prison Abu Ghraib was making its way up the chain of command. That's the discussion that we've heard all this past week and more, and that would have presumably been from Baghdad to Lieutenant General Sanchez, and then up to CENTCOM and General Abizaid, and then back to the Pentagon and up the chain of command there. Is Donald Rumsfeld, if he thought this was urgent, the kind of manager who would say, I want that report on my desk in 5 minutes, or is he the kind of guy who would say, I want to wait till that makes its way up through everybody else through channels?
The former. He's the kind of guy who would say, I want that report in 5 minutes or less.
He's had a lot of jobs in a lot of administrations, going back to Secretary of Defense in the Ford administration, where I think he was the youngest Secretary of Defense in history. So given his history, again, when he's under fire, as he is at this moment, how in general does he react? Is he one of those people who will dig his heels in and fight to the last ditch, or is he somebody who would say, look, if it's hurting the president, I'll offer my resignation?
Well, here's my sense of him and his past. If the president were to ask him to leave, he would leave. He wouldn't fight that. Obviously, he serves at the pleasure of the president. He knows that. He wouldn't. It's not someone who would say, "I'm not going to resign. You have to fire me."
Mm-hmm.
He would go. But on the other hand, it would have to come from the president. It wouldn't be because people in the press or in Congress or even the National Security Advisor were suggesting that he should go. It would have to come directly from the president.
It would have to come from the, even if, say, some influential senators, and yes, some have called for his resignation today, but they're on the Democratic side of the aisle. If this were instead, I don't know, John McCain and John Warner calling for his resignation, might he look at that differently?
No, I don't think this wouldn't be whispers or even calls from influential Republican senators. It would have to be from the president himself, and then I think it would be immediate. Again, he wouldn't have any problem with resigning rather than being replaced.
And again, any resignation is, as far as we know, not in the cards. The president's press secretary, Scott McClellan, today reiterated what he described the president's strong support for Secretary Rumsfeld. He will, however, face a difficult hearing tomorrow before the Senate Armed Services Committee. And to leap ahead, two steps ahead of speculation, an email question from John in St. Paul, Minnesota, who writes, if Rumsfeld does resign, who might his replacement be, and would that replacement necessarily handle Iraq any better? Any thoughts on that question?
I can't say, you know, nothing specific on who his replacement would be. It would be from outside. That is, it would not be, I don't believe it would be the Deputy Secretary of Defense, Paul Wolfowitz. It would be someone from outside who would be perceived as really taking control and bringing in some new perspective.
Donald Rumsfeld has had early on a meteoric career where he rose to the office of Secretary of Defense younger than any man who's ever held it before. This is sort of a coda to his career. A lot of people were surprised that, given his age, that he wanted to come back into government service at this point.
Yeah, he didn't campaign. He definitely campaigned to be part of the Bush team, in the sense that he got very active in Republican foreign policy in the 1990s, but not specifically for Secretary of Defense, at least not directly. During the 2000 campaign and in the immediate aftermath, Rumsfeld was in line to become CIA director. And then two things happened. One was that Bush's father, the senior George Bush, felt that you should not replace the CIA director at the beginning of a new administration. It shouldn't be perceived as a political job. And George Tenet, it was touch and go whether he would stay on the job, of course, is still on the job 4 years later at CIA. The second thing that happened of tremendous importance for the following 4 years is that there arose a groundswell within the Republican Party and among conservatives that Colin Powell might have too much power as Secretary of State, and that there needed to be an extremely strong Secretary of Defense to, in effect, keep Colin Powell in check. And Rumsfeld fit the bill. So the original idea had been to appoint a governor or a senator, maybe Tom Ridge, to be Secretary of Defense. And at the last minute, Rumsfeld was brought in.
He had been, just before that, the head of a panel that looked towards, a lot of the issues that he trumpeted at the beginning of his term as Secretary of Defense.
That's
transformation.
Right.
He was talking about future technologies and their effect on the military.
And also missile defense. He was the head of a commission on missile defense in the 1990s, an issue he took on as Secretary of Defense. But that's exactly why it was thought he would go to CIA, because the Commission on Missile Defense was set up to review all the available intelligence, so he became involved in intelligence issues.
And the Secretary has obviously had a long career in outside of the Pentagon as well, in business. How has that affected him in terms of how he sees the world and how he runs the very large corporation, if you want to look at it that way, that's in that five-sided building in Northern Virginia?
Well, in the first place, he was an extremely tough business executive. There were stories at Searle of people being in an airport in some other city and being called back and fired as soon as they got back. He was named at one point one of the 100 toughest business executives in the country. And so I think that he didn't, as Secretary of Defense in this administration, He ran it the same way. If he wasn't going to make special allowances for government, if he wanted to move people around, he'd do it. And if he wanted to butt heads, he'd do it.
Let's get a caller on the line. This is Bob, who's with us from Coon Rapids, Minnesota.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Bob.
I have a question about the policy of Mr. Rumsfeld in terms of using contact tractors. It seems that we have the second largest number of troops or mercenaries we hire, an even greater number than British troops. Is that common to all secretaries of defense at wartime, or is it specific for Rumsfeld?
Well, the key words you added were during wartime. This trend began before Rumsfeld. I mean, this is a trend that began in the 1990s, but has really taken off in this administration, and you know, with the in the time of war with Iraq, it served a bunch of needs for the Pentagon. So it didn't start with Rumsfeld. It's not unique to Rumsfeld. You know, the war in Iraq is the largest military operation in many years, and so that accelerated the whole process.
Bob, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
As you look back, James Mann, on the political history of previous secretaries of defense, do you remember one coming under this kind of fire in recent years? I remember if you go back to McNamara's time in Vietnam, but between then and now?
Well, in a different way. The first President Clinton's first Secretary of Defense,
Les Aspin, yes.
only stayed on the job for about a year, the charge against him, both within the Pentagon and at the Clinton White House, was that he was a poor manager. Things were really slipshod, so he came under fire and he resigned, but not as a result of a furor like this.
And so this is a relatively, I don't want to say it's a, qualify the word unique, but it's been some time then before a secretary has come under this kind of pressure.
Yes.
Okay. As you look back at the long life of tell us a little bit about how Donald Rumsfeld, the new Vulcans, how he assembled this team. Were these people who were in place to some degree and he came in at the top, or were these his choices, people like Paul Wolfowitz?
You mean Rumsfeld's own team?
Yes.
It's interesting. Some of them, quite a few of them, including his own deputy, Paul Wolfowitz, had worked for Dick Cheney in the Pentagon in the last Bush administration. That's true of Douglas Feith. It's true of several people down through the ranks in the Pentagon.
By the way, we should let listeners know we promised you an update from Baghdad. We're having a little difficulty getting through on the phones to Baghdad, and that happens from time to time. I hope you'll bear with us. In the meantime, an email question for you, James Mann. I'm no fan of the Bush administration, writes Natalie Van Dyke in Orange Park, Florida, but I have to say I'm a closet fan of Secretary Rumsfeld, if only for his sharp wit and the manner in which he at least appears to cut to the chase. Even if this is only in appearance, the guy possesses showmanship. How much does the Secretary of Defense really affect day-to-day operations of the military anyway? What's this guy's real job description?
Well, people in the Pentagon would be astounded to hear that question with respect to Rumsfeld, because he really sort of took control from the beginning and has asserted himself on things that in the past, really, the uniformed military was happy to do on its own. He's been aggressive, intrusive, and a very hands-on manager. The question, the caller is correct on Rumsfeld's ability on his feet. That's something that he's shown throughout his career. In fact, the people in the Nixon administration saw him as probably the best spokesman they could come up with for the Nixon administration around the country, and got frustrated every once in a while they couldn't get Rumsfeld to defend the Nixon administration more than he did.
We're speaking with James Mann. His book is The Rise of the Vulcans, The History of Bush's War Cabinet. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a caller on the line. Peter's with us from Rockville, Maryland.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure, Peter.
One of the things I wanted to ask Mr. Mann about, Rumsfeld has a long history. I mean, 25 years ago, he wrote a book, Rumsfeld Rules, mm-hmm. where he said his rules that he had learned through his executive experience. And one of those rules was that arguments of convenience lack integrity and inevitably trip you up. I wonder if a younger and wiser Donald Rumsfeld wrote that and he no longer believes it. Here's a guy who, by all accounts, is an aggressive manager, and yet he seems hopelessly out of touch and unable to answer fundamental questions about major mishaps in policy that are costing billions of dollars. And I just wonder, going forward, if that doesn't change, if he's not held accountable, how can we support that? How can we, get out of this?
Well, James Mann, perhaps more on the background than on the Those other questions, Peter, to be fair, they seem better posed to the senators we had on earlier in the program. I'm sorry you couldn't get
I'm not sure I have any. It's an interesting observation. Rumsfeld did write these rules, and the caller's right. I'm not sure that anybody lives up to their own rules. Certainly Rumsfeld hasn't lived up to all of his own rules that he wrote many years ago, and one wonders if at the end of his time as Secretary of Defense, or at the end of this administration, whether he's going to write an updated version of Rumsfeld's rules.
Peter, thanks for calling us.
All right,
bye-bye. Email from Frank Leffler in College Park, Maryland. What's the argument for requesting his resignation? Is it just that there's a controversy 8 to 10 steps down the chain of command? Then doesn't this seem a bit overzealous? What could the administration possibly gain from his resignation? And again, possibly better put to the senators we had on earlier, but James Mann, you're who we've got.
Well, the question, what is the argument for? The argument is that when something goes this seriously wrong, that someone at a senior level should take responsibility for it, even if it happens several levels down the chain of command. That's the classic argument. This is not specific to Rumsfeld. That's always the argument for in a case like this.
And again, the president's displeasure thus far has been limited to complaints about Secretary Rumsfeld not telling him in a timely manner about the terrible pictures that were broadcast a week ago tonight on 60 Minutes 2, and the president wanted to know about that in advance. The president, though, has spent much of the past 2 days speaking with Arab media, doing what is generally referred to as damage control on an issue that it's pretty clear he would prefer never to have come up in the first place. And again, there's calls from many Democratic senators and leaders in the House of Representatives on the Democratic side that somebody has to take responsibility and accountability stops in this particular chain of command with the Secretary of Defense. Donald Rumsfeld will be facing a very interesting meeting of the Senate Armed Services Committee tomorrow. That is said to be why he canceled his speech today that had been long scheduled in Philadelphia. He wanted to prepare for the questions that he'll be facing tomorrow before the Senate Armed Services Committee, and I guess that's going to be the next step in this story. Whether it develops further, we'll have to stay tuned. James Mann, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Neil.
James Mann is the author of The Rise of the Vulcans, The History of Bush's War Cabinet. He's also a senior writer in residence at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., and he joined us from his home in suburban Maryland. When we come back from a short break, a look at the future of Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and here are some of today's headlines at NPR News. At a Rose Garden news conference earlier this hour, President Bush said that Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld would stay a member of his cabinet, despite calls for Rumsfeld's resignation in the wake of the story of mistreatment of Iraqi prisoners by U.S. forces in Iraq. Also today, the president said he's deploying U.S. military aircraft to help U.S. government broadcast get into Cuba. Cuba has been jamming Miami-based Radio Marti and TV Marti. Details on those stories coming up later today on All Things Considered. Tomorrow on Science Friday, Ira Flatow looks at a new report on the health of the oceans, plus is the U.S. falling behind in science? All that tomorrow on Talk of the Nation Science Friday. And we have been able to get through to Iraq. U.S. troops today have been involved in military skirmishes in and around the holy cities of Najaf and Karbala. Soldiers have been stationed outside those cities for weeks in a standoff with rebel Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Other Shiite leaders have been negotiating with the U.S. to avoid a siege, particularly in Najaf. Daniel Williams is a reporter for The Washington Post. He was in Najaf yesterday traveling with the military and joins us now on the phone from Baghdad. I appreciate your staying with us and enabling us to finally get through, Daniel.
Thank you.
Give us an update, if you could. What's the situation now in Najaf?
In Najaf, the situation is relatively calm. The Americans, I believe the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment with tanks and other armored vehicles, are on the grounds of the governor's office. That's the equivalent of a mayor's office, very close to the center of town. There's some talk in the city, according to our correspondents down there, that the al-Sadr's Mahdi army militia will launch some sort of a counterattack later in the evening, but
for the moment, nothing's happening.
You were traveling near Najaf yesterday with Brigadier General Mark Hertling. What did he tell you about U.S. Offensive operations? Are they planning to go in and get Muqtada al-Sadr?
Well, that seemed to be out of bounds for the moment. He repeated to me several times, as did other commanders, that they want Iraqis to persuade or cajole or somehow force Muqtada al-Sadr out of Kufa, where he seems to be, not Najaf, but they're twin cities about just a few miles apart. In any case, in the meantime, Hertling said that the Americans would try to chip away at his militia and the aura of authority that he's exercised in Najaf, Kufa, Karbala, and other Shia towns, and that they began yesterday by destroying some buildings they held in Karbala and Diwaniya. These are both southern Shiite towns. And today, by taking the governor's office, which apparently was under the control of the militia.
What do you, or what can you tell us about the internal dynamic within the Shiite leadership? It's somewhat amorphous, but there have been calls by at least some Shia leaders for Mr. Muqtada al-Sadr to, get out of the way and stop defying U.S. authorities.
Right, pretty much across the board, that's been the demand. He's not a popular figure among senior clerics in the sort of Shia hierarchy of seniority and religious training. And he's not a favorite of secular Shia leaders either. That said, the what if he doesn't has not been made clear. There's certainly no indication they give the United States a green light to do the kind of massive attacking on Kufa, or for that matter, Najaf, that American Marines did over the past several weeks in Fallujah. So, again, chipping around at the edges, asserting American authority and, by extension, Iraqi authority in towns that have been bedeviled by al-Sadr seems to be the goal at the moment. That said, since they're fighting back in Najaf and to a certain extent in Karbala, where the Americans also entered again today, it's not clear that everything can be as well calibrated as the Americans would like.
You mentioned Fallujah before we let you go. I know one of your colleagues has traveled up to that city today, of course, in the Sunni area of Iraq, west of Baghdad. It's where four American contract workers were brutally murdered last month and where the city was under siege in heavy fighting until a deal was reached. How's that working out?
Well, he describes the place as he calls it a time machine. You suddenly see Iraqis in uniforms used during the days when Saddam Hussein ruled Iraq. They have kept the peace. There seems not to be fighting. Still at issue is whether they will comply with the American demands, which was that fighters in Fallujah, including foreigners, give up their weapons and that the foreigners be turned over to the Americans. There's no indication that that process in any way is underway. Furthermore, the bringing back of former Saddam Hussein officers to carry out this operation has upset especially Shia leaders who don't want them to have sort of a place in the power hierarchy that's developing in Iraq.
So political tensions on many fronts. Daniel Williams, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Daniel Williams, a reporter for The Washington Post. He joined us by phone from the newspaper's bureau in Baghdad.